sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Another OPEC rumor and another price surge. Negative reaction to negative rates. Gold continues to rally. Should this be something to be concerned about? And we have two great guests, Jordan Goodman, America's Money Answer Man, and Professor Ray Yao of the University of Missouri on behavioral finance. All this and much more on episode number 450 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, Andrew Horowitz here, and happy Valentine's Day to you and your loved ones, everybody that's celebrating some type of Valentine's Day today. I've been getting all sorts of these bemojis. Have you guys been getting these bemojis? Have you made one? I haven't done it. I just can't bring myself to do it. These iMessages with these pictures that you kind of put your own little caricature on. I don't know. Seems like fun, but not something I'm going to do. What a waste of time. People are getting less and less able to actually write or talk, it seems, these days. Now everything is just one meme that describes everything. It's kind of a way of providing information through pictures. Going back to hieroglyphics, it seems, or something. I don't know. But anyway, it is episode number 450. It is now the mid part of February 2016. And clearly there is a tremendous amount of, well, I would say negativity surrounding the whole negative rates issue. The latest move by the Bank of Japan has been absolutely killing the yen. The yen has been, in terms of strengthening it. Now you have to remember something, that the yen is a major component of how Japan markets function. Because the strength of the yen, or the weakness of the yen, either way you want to look at it, are something that really provides a tremendous amount of lift or drop to the exports of Japan. Their country is so designed to be, really centrally profitable based on the value of the yen. And that's why Shinzo Abe, for the last couple of years with his Abenomics, has been doing what he can to force the yen to be lower and lower, and that has provided for an increase in exports and thereby increasing the profitability of those companies. And when you look at what happened after the negative rates, which should, by the way, have been a reaction to weaken the yen, that was the intent, was to weaken the yen even further by very significant mechanisms and measures by the Bank of Japan, it backfired on them dramatically. And what happened is we saw probably one of the greatest rallies in the yen that we've seen in some time. And that resulted in a massive sell-off in the Japanese markets, down about 14% over the last 5 days, the Nikkei. That's not something to overlook. Now, fortunately, one of the things that we are finding is that while the Fed had danced around the discussion last week when Yellen was speaking in front of Congress, the whole idea that, well, negative rates was something we talked about back in, 2010. There was a discussion on Friday by Dudley, who came out and said that negative rates shouldn't even be on the discussion board at this point, which is good because we've seen what has happened in both Europe and Japan with this negative rates, which I have found to be a very, very poor decision by the central banks. I'm very skeptical about the whole idea of negative rates. I don't think it's going to provide what they're looking for, which is to push more money back into the economy by forcing banks to do things that are riskier than they want to. And the negative rate environment that we're seeing, we've seen a couple of different discussions about this, it is highly experimental. And I think it leads to investors believing that it is more than a last-ditch effort. It is panic by the central banks to try their best to create a currency war of some kind. Maybe that's not what their intent is, but they're trying to knock down their currency, which in turn then causes other countries to do the same thing. What's fascinating is that we raised rates here in the U.S. at the end of December, and mortgage rates are the lowest they've been in 10 months. We hit 1.75% on the 10-year last week. This is all in the face of a deflationary environment due to not only commodity prices, but consumers really, their sentiment coming back and peeling back a little bit. You know, retail sales not doing much. Demand very low. And they're trying to do what they can do to try to push in some kind of, which is really amazing, push in more loan use by forcing banks to take money out of deposits at the central bank and push it out into the street, backfiring dramatically. And I got to tell you something, this is hopefully going to be a very good lesson to our central bank not to go ahead with this, because it really hurts banks' profits and is so experimental, really, for a major economy that we don't know what's going to happen. And the experiment as of right now is failing just at a level that is unprecedented. So I think that the good news is that we weren't the first to do this. However, the impact on the world of this negative rate move may be something that is very significant, especially if we do see a panic in the opposite direction. Either one, them saying, you know what, this isn't working, markets don't like it, we're going to kind of lay off of this a little bit and we'll pull back. Maybe we'll take back some of the idea of this negative rate move, and we won't, at least if nothing else, we won't increase the negative side of what we're doing. Next week, we have Mario Draghi talking, and the idea is that maybe he'll even try to do more stimulus. And if, in fact, he goes even further into negative rate territory, I have a really bad feeling that markets are going to be very, very upset. Hopefully, he got the message of this as well after seeing what's going on in Japan. But you never know. They kind of beat their own drummer, these central bankers, which have gone off the reservation. I mean, really off the reservation, to a point that is just, they really have to rein in their thought that they have the ability to really change the whole dynamic of markets. It's one thing to provide interest rates at a very low basis and to flood the economy with liquidity and increase the monetary base. I get that. But to go to this effect, bad news. Well, before we get to our guest, let's talk a little bit about what happened last week and some of the things that we're going to look forward to next week. Once again, we saw there was a rumor towards the end of the week, right at the bottom, right where there was support almost breached on the S&P 500 about 1812. Very timely release of a rumor that OPEC and non-OPEC nations are going to possibly get together. Once again, this is the third week we've seen this, to do something about stabilizing the price of oil. On the heels of that, oil jumped about 12% on Friday. That was pretty amazing. Up to about 29.5. Overall, it was down about 5% for the week, close to about, 4.7% for the week was the actual fall for oil again. And this major move up. Now, the last few times we've seen this and there was no actual action that happened, oil fell right after that. Now, this is becoming the OPEC who cried wolf, and I don't know if we're going to be able to see any kind of stabilization here unless they actually do something about the productivity and the amount of oil they're bringing up. But we do know that they really don't want to do so. They've announced this several times. They don't want to stop productivity and production because they are, you know, having a problem already with the fact that price is so low. And why would they do so? We did see that markets, on the heels of all this concern about European banks in the U.S. that have exposure to oil-related companies and loans and lines of credits and revolvers, et cetera, are having big problems. Earnings have been coming in, okay. While we are seeing the beat of about, I think it's about 68, 69% of companies are beating estimates. These are much lower estimates than we've seen. We're seeing about a 4, 5% drop in earnings growth. So we did see that the Dow Jones was down about 1.5% for the week, NASDAQ down about 0.5%, and the S&P was down 1.95% for the week. Now, gold was been rallying, and I was wondering, should this have been something that we're really paying attention to a little bit more? Because gold has been rallying, closed at about 1239, one of its best weeks since 2008, and its first four-week winning streak since last April. Now, think about that. Gold has been rallying. Now, the dollar has been coming down a bit, so you get that kind of situation, but yet oil, even with the dollar coming back and falling, has not been rallying, except for the rumors. But is this kind of something that we should be looking at as, wait a minute, why are all these investors flocking back to gold? Why are they going back to the gold miners? Even Freeport-McMoRan Copper, which has some gold exposure, has been doing very well. I think it's up close to about 80% from its low. And while markets did, in fact, rally as gold was rallying and as, more importantly, oil was rallying on the news on Friday, who knows if this is just a reaction, kind of a quick snapback, dead cat bounce, you want to call it, in a market that looks like it's going into bear territory. We'll have to see if this is sustainable. But this gold, I would keep gold on your radar right now to watch its direction and watch its strength and to see if this is something much bigger than just a rotation trade, looking for the most beaten down areas to get back into after gold had a pretty tough 2 years, if it's just related to the dollar or if it actually is a safe haven play that there's going to be a lot more moving towards. Retail sales showed an increase last month of a whopping 0.2%. Core retail sales were up about 0.6%, which excluded the auto and home and restaurants. But I got to tell you, this has been exciting, I guess, that we're seeing a level of growth that is 0.2%? I don't think so. Now, we saw the University of Michigan's initial February consumer sentiment index move to about 90.7 on Friday. The end of January, it was 92. And this is down towards a six-month low, which kind of makes some sense. We usually see a correlation between what happens with markets, the economy, and with consumer confidence, and it's falling. So that's obviously makes a good amount of sense there. We saw that the mortgage rates on the 30-year is now at 3.65, a 10-month low, and the 15-year is at 2.95%. Now, coming up this week, we know that Monday is President's Day, that we'll see the markets in the U.S. are closed. On Tuesday, we're going to see earnings from Cheesecake Factory. We're going to see Fossil Group, Kaiser Aluminum, Public Storage. Now, we have the minutes from the Federal Reserve policy meeting is going to be released on Wednesday. And we're going to see January PPI, so the producer price index, see what's going on with inflation or the lack thereof, along with housing starts, building permits, and industrial output. We're also going to see some earnings from Denny's, Domino's, and Jack in the Box, Garmin, Lazy Boy, Marathon Oil, Newmont Mining, Noble Energy, NVIDIA, Priceline. That'll be something to watch after we saw that nice number come out last week on Expedia. Then we're going to also see on Thursday new initial claims and earnings from Applied Materials, Cabela's, Dish Network, Hyatt Hotels, MGM Resorts, Nordstrom, and Starwood Hotels. And then also we'll see Walmart. On Friday, January CPI, and quarterly results from Deere. We'll see how this company, now watch this, if in fact the yen has been rallying, and one of the reasons I had talked about some time ago and continue on with my thesis is that Caterpillar and Deere are going to see a lot of competitive pressures, which they did, Caterpillar being more so than Deere. Is this going to see a turnaround now moving forward for Deere and Caterpillar earnings? Let's keep a watch for that. Now, other than that, obviously, the markets are closed. We'll see what happens with Japan. There'll probably be a snapback on Monday with the Japanese markets as futures on the Nikkei rallied with the futures and the markets on Friday for the U.S. And if nothing else, being down 14% in about a week probably deserves for some bottom feeders to come in and start buying some of the shares there of the Nikkei. So I would say that's probably something you're going to see and something that's going to happen. But I think that one of the big issues here is going to be that while the markets here in the U.S. are down about 14% from their peak vis-a-vis the S&P 500, the question is going to be, are we also going to see some kind of massive move to the downside if we don't and are unable to hold these rallies? A lot of it will be predicated on the price of oil. We know that because that's been a big issue right now with banks in the financial area. We saw that utilities and staples had been probably the best two sectors in the U.S. this year, which is clearly a trade that people go in when they're concerned with markets, looking for safety. But I would venture to say that that 1775 level, the likelihood of it being tested is pretty high. I hope that's not the case necessarily, but at 1775, maybe even 1750, that becomes a market with valuation that is very, very attractive. I hope that we do see that quote-unquote capitulation, that flush. That would be actually a good thing in these markets because what we've seen lately is more so just of a continual selling and drawdown. Every move to the upside towards the end of the week has been brought down the next week. Is it different this time? Is now the sustainability of the oil price going to hold and be something that we can count on? Or is this just another rumor that's going to be sold and we're going to see that oil does continue down back towards that ultimate target that people are talking about in the 20s? In the low 20s, that is. We'll have to see what happens with that. Anyway, we do have two guests. Before we get to them, I just want to mention that if you have any questions, of course, you can send them to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I know we had talked about doing some discussion of Horowitz & Company and the various strategies that we have this week, but because we have so many guests lined up, I guess I misspoke a little bit. We'll get to that very shortly. If you have anything that you want to know about what we do, of course, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Plenty of information over there. And of course, any questions you have, just ask me. Follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the Twitter handle on that. And we'll go from there. And our guest today is Jordan Goodman, also known as America's Money Answer Man. You can find him on moneyanswers.com. Is that with an S, Jordan, or not?
That is with an S, Andrew, yes.
Okay, moneyanswers.com. He's written 14 books. Amazing. One of the ones that you may want to look at is Fast Profits in Hard Times, amongst many others. Very frequently seen on CNN, CNBC, CBS. He's got some radio shows. He is the guy that we turn to for some money answers. So, Jordan, let's get down with some of the things that are going on with the current markets. And one of the things I really wanted to focus in on with you was this whole concept of what do you do if you just don't want to be involved in this? Like, where's a safe haven?
Right. So that there are safe havens in this environment. I think we're in a global deflationary cycle. We've had many decades here of increasing the amount of debt, and the bills come and do, Andrew, is what it comes down to.
Yep.
And so there's debts in the oil patch. There's debts in the emerging markets. There's debts in consumer debt. There's mortgage. There's just a lot of debts, governmental debts, and it's just too much. And the lenders are calling the loans, kind of think of it that way. So I think we have a lot further to go down in the stock market. Another 30% or so this year alone, from even though lower levels. And so it's a time for safe havens. I agree with you. This is a time to hold on to your principal, earn a decent yield, and avoid all the wreckage that's going to be happening in the aggressive parts of the market. So I'll tell you one thing I'm doing myself, which might be of interest to the listeners. I'm doing what are called commercial mortgage bridge loans. And there's a website for that, commercialmortgagebridgeloans.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of earning 6%. Super safely over 1 year. You get monthly interest checks, get your money back at the end of the year. So basically what they're doing is lending money to high quality commercial real estate projects, hotels, shopping centers, apartment buildings, medical buildings, some kind of commercial property. They can't get loans to do their projects because the banks are so super tight because of the Dodd-Frank and other regulations. They go to the private market, get these bridge loans, do their project for a year, pay interest, get their project done, pay it back, and then they can go on with their life instead of trying to convince a bank to give them a loan, which would take them 6 months, and they get rejected anyway, basically.
So these loans, are they first on the property?
Correct.
Well, first of all, let me kind of back up a second. Is this on new development or on expansion?
Mostly existing properties. This is existing properties. They don't really do new construction as such. But they're doing renovation or you know, some kind of improvement on an existing property. They may add square footage. They might be repurposing it. I'll just give you a recent example. There was a home that was in a college town, and it was an individual home. They repurposed it so they could have four students renting there. So their income would go up, you see. Right, so they kind of redid the house to increase the cash flow from it. Another one, there was a Hawaiian hotel resort that was kind of a little bit run down. It was appraised at $14 million. The guy borrowed $3 million to fix up the rooms, make the rooms much nicer, put a new restaurant in, and he was willing to pay interest rates for a year, and he couldn't get a loan from a local Hawaiian bank. But his cash flow is going to be much better now that the property's improved. Those are just two kind of examples.
So you're going to take a piece of this action, whereas they're going to put this...
It's not equity, right?
Of course.
Lender.
Right.
They technically call them first position commercial mortgages. So you are in first position. And typically the loan originator that puts these deals together takes a second position behind you with a, I wouldn't use the word guarantee, but, you know, kind of an insurance fund behind you. So if in the unlikely chance the borrower does not make payments on time, the money is already sitting there to make absolutely sure you get interest and principal as due.
Interesting. All right, so that's one thing. So we got the commercial mortgage bridge loans, which involve real estate on either fixing up or expansion or something of that nature, about give or take 6% on that.
And so 7%. One year paper.
Right.
So the short money back. And just so to be clear, there's no fees or commissions or asset management charges of any kind, because the way the loan originator is making their money is they're charging a spread over the 6% of the borrower. Mm-hmm. Maybe say another 4 points. Say they charge a total of 10.
Right.
So they would keep 4, you get 6. But that means from your point of view as the investor, 100% of what you invest gets 6%. Instead of having commissions to get in and out of things, spreads you would have on bonds, asset management fees on mutual funds, none of that. So 100% of your money. In this environment, which I said is deflationary, if you keep your principal safe, earn a decent yield, your purchasing power is increasing. That's a different mindset for a lot of people. Yeah. They're always thinking
what is inflation. What is that? But what about now in terms of, we get into the nitty gritty about this one, but we'll just spend one more moment on this.
Sure.
So if there's a total 10%, you get 6, 4, whatever the exact split is, are you behind the originator in terms of?
No, they're behind you.
They're behind you. Okay, so.
You're in first position.
First position.
They're in second position.
Mm-hmm. All right, gotcha. Because
they've got every incentive in the world to make sure you get paid, because they don't get paid unless you get paid.
Exactly.
So you're the investor at first, and they're very, very careful about that. They do a title search. They buy title insurance. They make sure there are no other tax liens or any kind of liens in front of you. And so, I mean, 99.5% of the time, the borrowers pay on time. They really don't want to lose their buildings, okay? Right, they're trying to improve their buildings. Yep. Not improve. So it's worked out very, very well, and it's completely separate from the stock market, bond market. And the other thing is, if interest rates were to go up, you're going to get hurt big time in bonds.
Right.
And here, a year later, you get your money back. You could reinvest at higher rates. Hmm. So it affects you, protects you against higher rates as well as lower rates. I mean, they have the long treasury today down to almost 1.5%. It's amazing how much it's gone down.
Yep.
And here you're getting 6 versus 1.5 with no capital fluctuation of any kind and no fees. Anyway, for part of your portfolio, that's something that might be helpful. So again, the website, commercialmortgagebridgeloans.com, is probably going to help some of your folks.
Now, you're talking about, you've been talking about this whole idea of, as we know, a deflationary environment.
Right.
Now we've been having this whole negative rate hoo-ha, which, by the way, every time I say it, the hair on the back of my neck stands up a little bit. Seriously.
Well, it's getting serious. The 10-year Japanese treasury is now negative.
Yeah, I know.
The 10-year, not the 1-year.
I hear you. I really, seriously, because the whole idea, you know, it seems to me that, and I've been really talking about this a lot, that, okay, so central banks are doing what they can, a lot of stimulus, and even though we hiked rates a little bit, everybody else is kind of keeping them low and talking about, and then they throw out of a curveball of this negative rates here, and all of a sudden markets really kerplock, you know, especially after Japan.
It's deflationary, okay?
When it's terrible.
Japan going into negative rates for the 10-year, the German 9-year is at negative rates as well. I mean, all the strong countries around the world, Japan, Germany, France, Denmark, and so on, have negative rates, Switzerland. The weak countries, Portugal, Greece, Spain, their rates are going up. There's a big spread widening between the unhealthy and the healthy, not only countries, but companies as well. I mean, you're seeing the junk bond market getting killed here because people want, they want safety. They want to flee from anything that's got default risk. And I think there's going to be a huge amount of defaults in the junk bond market. About 25% of the junk bond market is oil related.
Right,
and they are going to be defaulting like crazy this year. They're already starting.
How interesting do you find it that the term CDS or contingent default swaps have all of a sudden been crept into the conversation? Very, I think, very recently.
Well, it's a very good indicator of what the market thinks is the default risk on something. So, for example, you've seen the CDSs soar on places like Deutsche Bank, okay? I mean, who would have thought Deutsche Bank, you know, would be a risky situation?
Mm-hmm.
The Italian banks, all these. It's a very sensitive indicator of default risk is what it comes down to. And I like to listen to the market. I don't tell the market. I listen to the market.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll give you another example.
Like the market won't listen to you anyway, by the way, just to let you know.
Well, right. But I'm just saying, I'm not speaking to it. I'm listening to what it's telling me. Another example, the Baltic Dry Index, which sounds like a really obscure index. Mm-hmm. That's the index of what it costs to ship stuff around the world. That has plummeted off a shelf. I mean, just dramatically.
All-time low this week.
That is telling you there's less demand to ship stuff. There's a lot of ships that are empty and not going anywhere. Some of them are filled with oil, and there's no place to offload the oil because all the storage facilities are already filled.
Yeah, crazy.
This is deflationary stuff. You have too much stuff, not enough demand.
And the problem is actually, and we'll end on this point on this, though, that you know central banks are still very, very dovish, very stimulative and all that. And the problem is we're still seeing this problem. And where is it emanating from? It's, I mean, obviously China, and you know you see that. You know, the retail sales have not picked up. Even with, you know, it's really fascinating. I don't know what your take is on this, but the whole idea that gas prices sub $2 in a lot of places, everybody's like, oh, first of all, the commentators on TV, they're all like, oh, gas prices at $5. It really doesn't bother the consumer. They're
that's
okay
crazy.
And then they're like, well, gas prices at $2. They're like, well, that's great for the consumer. I'm like, how can you have it both ways? That doesn't make any sense.
All right, so, I mean, I'm in touch with consumers all the time, as are you. I'm talking to them. I'm doing radio shows. I'm hearing what they're saying. What people are doing with the savings from gas is either saving it, earning nothing on their money, but at least saving it, or paying down debt, credit card debt and other kinds of things. They are not going on wild spending sprees, as these top-down economists were saying, oh, this windfall is going to be like a tax cut for everybody. That's not when people are scared, as they are now, they don't go spend it. They pay down debt and they save it. So the savings rate has roughly doubled from 2% to almost over 5% in the last year or so because people are very concerned. There's a negative wealth effect when the stock market goes down as it has been. And people pull in their horns and are much more cautious about spending, even though they're not actually selling their stocks. It has a psychological impact that affects real economic impact. They don't.
Right.
Maybe you don't have to buy that car. Maybe we shouldn't make that real estate investment, whatever it may be. People pull their horns in. During deflation, you are paid to wait.
You know, it's interesting because I remember back in 2007, back in 2005, 2006, I was getting really, really antsy about the housing market. I mean, really, I was actually standing on the table and yelling at people and they thought I was a lunatic. I'm like, I'm telling you, there is something really bad about to happen here. And I remember 2008 when the crap is hitting the fan and all sorts of problems and all that. And it really was, you know, we were set up pretty well from our company as things were going, you know, okay for us. And we were, but, and really we didn't see a drop in our fees and all that. But I went around, I remember that day, one day I went around the office and I took a pad and I very slowly walked around the entire office. And I said, okay, you know what? We don't need that water purifier anymore. That's stupid. We don't need that stamp machine the way it is right now. We can get a smaller one. Why are we paying this money for this copy machine when really all we do is scan and every once in a while use this thing? I went around the office and I looked at all these different things and all these different recurring charges and I just cut the crap out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's what happens during a downturn. People look to cut costs every way possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's the negative wealth effect in your case. That's right. And that's happening on a major scale. Now, in 2007, 2008, it was a real estate bubble. Now it's an energy bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think it's even bigger. You know, we had a huge amount of money lent when oil was $100 or more a barrel for all kinds of drilling projects. And that's not going to get paid back at $26 a barrel. Okay.
Right.
And you're going to see huge, we've already seen last year in 2015, there were 250,000 layoffs in the oil patch. This year, I think it'll be 500,000 or more. And you're going to have scores of companies going bankrupt.
Which don't you think it's really interesting how, the manufacturing is clearly in a recession. Services are doing okay. But don't you find it really fascinating how we continue to see reasonable amounts of employment builds in the face of all that's going on with the oil?
But look at the kind of jobs that are being created, Andrew, okay? You know, Yellen can say, 4.9% unemployment, everything's fine. Let's raise rates. Okay, this is insane. She should be taken off in a straitjacket, was saying something like
that. Right, exactly.
But okay, so look at the kinds of jobs being created. In the latest numbers we saw, retail, so, you know, store clerks, that's fine. Healthcare, orderlies, you know, nurses, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Education actually was down. Construction was down. Manufacturing is really bad. So the kinds of jobs being created are low-wage, no-benefit kind of jobs.
And temporary, possibly.
And temporary.
Or expendable.
And the jobs that are being lost, like in the oil patch, are high-wage, high-benefit kind of jobs.
Right.
Manufacturing, unionized kind of jobs. So you just can't say, oh, we have a lot of jobs being created. The kinds of jobs being created are not the kind that sustain a lot of economic growth and spending. So nobody seems to look at that, but that's the reality of what's actually happening out there. And it's going to continue. The manufacturing sector is going to keep getting hurt by the dollar, which is extremely strong. If the Fed raises rates, which would be insane, the dollar goes up even further, which hurts our manufacturers even more.
Right.
Now, I was actually in China somewhat recently. I can just tell you a story or two from China, if that would be interesting to you.
Yeah. I was just there this summer.
Yeah, I was there last summer, too. I was there. I was in Shanghai in August when the market was crashing.
Uh-huh.
It was
right.
kind of exciting.
Right.
So you probably saw the same thing. All this building going on everywhere.
The ghost cities were. I've talked about this at length with my listeners back then. The ghost cities are more horrifying than you can imagine,
and they're more being built.
Yeah,
I took the. Were you in Shanghai and Beijing? Where were you?
Yeah, I was south. I was all in Chengdu and Xi'an and the Sichuan province.
So I was in Beijing for a week, Shanghai for a week, and I took the bullet train between the two, which is a roughly a 5.5 hour. Train ride.
Ordeal.
No, it was wonderful.
I hear you. No, it's great. The bullet trains are great.
Great food. Very smooth, you know, the whole thing was wonderful. Except when you're looking out the window for 5.5 hours,
right?
You're seeing cranes and building and like, oh, there's a rice paddy. They're putting up a 50-story apartment building in the middle of nowhere, you know.
Right.
For 5.5 hours, I was seeing cranes. It was insane. In Shanghai, to go from the downtown area, which is called the Pudong, where the river is, out to the Pudong Airport, which is a beautiful new airport. It's about a half an hour highway. All along that highway, I'd say at least 50, maybe more, office buildings, apartments buildings being built all over the place. And I said, well, we're opening Shanghai Disney next year, so it'll all be fine. It's like, I don't think so.
I know.
So this is the greatest Ponzi scheme in world history, as far as I'm concerned. And the reason is all the money for doing all this is coming from the central bank, which is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. American banks would never make loans to do this kind of construction. But in China, it's a political thing. They want to have jobs and show growth and all that. But, you know, they can't overwhelm the market forever. And that's where I see less demand for all these worldwide commodities. That had been the engine of economic growth around the world. And that's why things are slowing down so much. It's going to slow down further as they just can't keep building all these ghost cities.
So I know we have limited time, but I want to ask you one thing and get your advice on something, because this actually happened today. I have someone I know, which we don't manage their portfolio, friend. About a year and a half ago, he showed me his portfolio. Let's just call it $500,000. And there was a lot of banks and a tremendous amount of oil in there, or oil-related companies in there. And I said to him about a year ago, I said, you know what? Maybe it was a year and a half ago. I said, you know what? You got, first of all, diversification problem. And second of all, I am really, really concerned about this. I said, you know, he said, what to do? I said, well, here's a few things you could do and all that. We can talk more. He says, you know, I got this money recently. It's an inheritance, blah, blah, blah. There was a lot of money made on these. Okay, that's the setup. So time goes on. 6 months later, and I called. I said, listen, but I'm really concerned about your portfolio. I'm not selling anything. Okay, all right, fine. Anyway, I honestly called him today, and I spoke to him. I said, listen, I just ran the numbers in your portfolio, and I'm horrified.
He's lost more than half his principal.
Yeah, I said, what are you doing? He said, I haven't sold anything. Now I can't sell. It's too late, which is the comment, by the way, he made months ago or 7 months ago.
Right.
And he said, what do I do? I said, well, I'm not going to tell him what I said because I want to hear what you would say. What do you tell somebody like that?
Where they are today?
Yeah, what do you do?
Sell. Okay. That's the word. Because you're going to take further losses. Okay, the oil companies have come down. They're just starting to cut their dividends. Conoco cut their dividend, what was it, 66%, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
These smaller companies, Anadarko, they're all cutting their dividends left and right. There's going to be no dividends coming from these things. Lots of them are going to go bankrupt. They will get zero. Okay, now not Exxon and Chevron, the big guys. Right, they're going to clean up on these other ones.
Right.
But their stocks are going to go down a lot too. So so much of this, Andrew, is psychological. It's not financial. It's like, oh, I can't afford to take a loss. It's like I'm admitting a mistake or something. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is disastrous for people. And banks, the same thing. I mean, banks have all these loans, not only to oil companies, but all kinds of smaller companies that are going to be in trouble here. There are exporters that are, you know, getting hurt by the strong dollar. So the banks are going to come down too. So with investing, you have to look forward. I always say with investing should be like driving. Should be you're looking in the with the looking forward. You're not driving by looking in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, that's something
sort of dangerous way to drive.
That's
right?
funny you mentioned. I tell people that all the time. I mean, we're not looking in the rearview mirror because what's the point of where it was? And I hope it's going to get back up to that point one day.
All the psychologists. The market doesn't owe you anything.
Right.
It's like, oh well, the market owes me at least to get even.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't.
Okay? I hear you.
So you have to deal with the reality of what's there today.
Yep.
And I would be completely out of oil or any materials, mining related stocks at all. And banks are going to get hurt as well. I mean, yep. REITs may be possible. Utilities are going to do well in this environment. Safe havens. That's the theme.
Staples and et cetera. Jordan Goodman, you can find him on moneyanswers.com. Of course, we'll have all the information about Jordan on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes of this particular episode. And you can find out more about him, plus his great books and one that recently came out. You can find that on Amazon and bookstores if there's any bookstores left, actually, or somewhere. Although Amazon's coming out with bookstores now, I guess. Anyway, you can find him all around and listen to him on all sorts of radio podcasts, et cetera. Jordan Goodman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
And we have another great guest with us today. This is Ray Yao. And Ray is actually an associate professor in the Personal Financial Planning Department at the University of Missouri in Columbia. And she writes and is on the editorial board of the Journal of Personal Finance and Journal of Asian Families. And she's got all sorts of credentials. So I'm glad to have you here today. How are you?
Hi, Andrew. I'm good. How are you? Thanks for asking. And thanks for the invitation to be on your podcast.
My pleasure. You got lots of good things that we can talk about because I think it's a really good time to talk about this whole notion of, as I would encapsulate it, behavioral finance and how people react to bad conditions in the markets. And I know you wrote a couple of articles and you've done a lot of research on this. But one of the things I want to ask you is, I guess one of your, I'll get to the bottom line here and then you can work backwards with me. So people make a lot of mistakes when things are ugly in the markets, right?
Right.
So why is that?
Well, because people are... They're either overconfident, they're loss averse, and the bottom line is they're inconsistent. What I mean by that is that, you know, people like money, right? And they would like to accumulate wealth, and the more the better. But oftentimes in the down market, they do things that lead to consequences that will help them lose money.
Right. So, for example, I guess a good example would be something like this. If somebody has all cash,
right,
and the market is down really bad, something really horrible happens, right? They're like, maybe I should buy in at this point, right?
Right.
On the other hand, if they're all invested and the market's down, mm-hmm. they do the opposite, right? I'm selling.
That's right, yeah.
So how do people kind of get beyond that and recognize where they're making those mistakes?
First of all, people should recognize that they are making mistakes. And let me tell you, how do I define mistakes? That is moving to more of a cash position where there is no consumption need. And consumption needs can be triggered by eruption of income. So in a down market, if you lose your job, obviously you need to probably tap into your nest egg. But here is the best opportunity to mention the emergency fund, right? So,
right.
Yeah, so dip into emergency fund before you tap into your investments. And another income, another consumption need can be triggered by retirement. So if you're retired and you're all invested, you don't have emergency fund, magic word. So what you do, you have to sell. And another reason would be some household changes. Say, for example, you have a son or a daughter who lost job and move in with you. So all of a sudden you have to provide for their consumption, or you have to take, you assume the responsibility of taking the elders, or you have divorced, or you have a new baby born in the family. So all of those demographic changes in the family can justify your behavior of moving to cash. I mean, you know, you're not moving to cash per se, you're just using money to fund your consumption. And that is perfectly okay. It is when people, out of fear, they don't have one of those situations happen to them, and they move to cash and stay in cash. And that's a problem.
So, you know, it's interesting because let's talk about the exact opposite. And you talk about when markets are down, people make errors because they're scared. And mm-hmm. what they'll do is sometimes they'll cash out at the wrong times or not make the right decisions that may say, well, you know, look at that stock, look at that investment, look at that whatever it is. There's a good opportunity there because they're so nervous about what's going to happen. But what about when things are really good? You know, when markets are flying high and maybe when they're, you know, we don't know any particular level on the downside or upside, but just things are just awfully good and they don't do anything either. Is that as much of a problem?
That can be a problem too. The best way, well, research has shown the best way to invest is to use dollar cost averaging. So, you know, on a monthly basis, if you have a retirement account, you know, have an IRA, 401k, 403b, you know, on a regular basis, you just invest in the market. So when the market is up and you have a ton of money and you think, I'm getting bullish and I want to invest, that's when you're likely to make a mistake too. So mistakes are two sides. One is to, we know the golden investment rule is to buy low and sell high. So if you violate any of this, it's not a good thing.
So one of the things that you wrote about, which I thought was kind of fascinating, was, and I think they quoted you in this article, that Asian Americans are often moved to cash positions during down markets because culturally they are much more likely to trade on the stock market more frequently and take a short-term investment approach as opposed to a more rational long-term approach. Now, is this something you've seen throughout, well, it wouldn't only be in the U.S., I guess it would be also, you know, brought over, quote-unquote, from Asia. Why is that? What's the story with that?
Well, the story behind is stock market. Say, for example, for Chinese investors, this is where I originally come from. The stock market is relatively new. And if you look at the demographics who enter the stock market, those people are not very well educated. I mean, not very well educated in terms of finance, you know.
Right.
So they don't understand and they think there's opportunity to park their money other than the CDs and the government bonds that they have been investing into or saving into. So they began to look at the stock market as a place where they can sort of gamble, and so they chase short returns, not realizing that each time they buy and then sell and each time they do all those transactions, they have tax consequences and they have costs. So historically, they have been trying to be market timers and get short-term use short-term strategies instead of long-term strategies.
It's kind of like the big baccarat game.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I spoke to one of the discount platform for those transactions. They have a whole Asian department working for them in the United States, in St. Louis. And they like Asian investors because they trade several times more than the traditional average American investor.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, it could also be because is it possible that there's a lack of trust due to the fact that we know from at least this side of the pond that there's some lack of regulation, lack of plan, lack of government transparency when it comes to the financial markets there? Is it possible it's a trust factor issue? You know, it's kind of like, all right, let me get in, and then if I make money, I'm out?
Yeah. I mean, I would say all of the above, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so now, in terms of a couple of things, when it comes to these markets, when they're moving down, you mentioned that in this article that the mistakes that people make are magnified. And let me ask you this. Is the whole point here that what takes over is emotion versus logic? Because that's something that I've talked about many times. I mean, I wrote, you know, in my book, it's like one of the opening lines of my first book that I wrote, which is that, you know, emotions can be an important thing to use in life. But when it comes to investing, kind of like sit it on the side, put it outside the door, check out and kind of move into logic, put your logic hat on, because you can't make decisions based on emotion when it comes to your money. Is that pretty much the encapsulation?
Exactly, exactly. Decision makers go through both a rational and emotional process. And in some situations, unfortunately, emotions take the dominating position.
Yeah.
So when they are afraid, when they don't know enough and they would like to, they're more likely to be emotional.
But what I don't understand something. When you talk about this whole emotional part, and one of the things that goes into emotional is the overconfidence factor that you studied.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand this still, so you're going to have to explain this to me. So you mentioned that overconfidence is a very key part of investment mistakes,
right?
And that if a person is too confident in the market or in their own abilities as an investor, they are much more likely to sell low which is illogical. So how does overconfidence in their abilities, are you saying that they're overconfident because they can predict, or is it underconfident in their abilities and that's why they sell, because they're like, oh, I must be wrong?
Well, in the up market, they're overconfident. And when they face the reality, when the down market eventually comes, and they're not prepared. So they're overconfident about their ability to take risks. However, when the test eventually comes, to test how risk tolerant you are, they show that I'm really not risk tolerant.
Right. Well, that's a classic. That's a classic. How aggressive are you? I'm very aggressive. I'm very aggressive. Okay. So we're going to invest for you.
But I can't take loss.
But yeah, no. Yeah, I want to make 20% a year, but maybe 2% loss. But I'm a very aggressive investor.
Right. Yeah.
Right. That's a big issue, because a lot of people are, you have to kind of match the cuff with a collar, in that I think it's important to understand that many investors don't really, they're aggressive investors in an up market, but their investment risk tolerance disappears and changes in a down market, which, you know, that could be okay in certain circumstances, right? If you happen to do it just right, but the likelihood of doing it right is a very difficult task, right?
Right. It is pretty difficult to actually, there is nothing that we can stick to your mouth or, you know, wipe around your forehead and say, oh, this is your risk tolerance.
Right.
We don't have that gadget. I wish we did. So a lot of times, you know, in the industry, people try to measure the clients or measure their own risk tolerance by answering some questions. But those questions and those answers can be determined by how good a day they're having or how confident they are, or, you know, do they have an argument with their spouse in the morning? So, and most of the times the risk tolerance questionnaire is answered one time and filed away. But unfortunately, people do change their risk tolerance when the market changes, and they are affected by their behavioral biases, which is one of them is to look at the recent market news and events and think, oh, this is going to continue forever.
Right. So they're going to elongate whatever it is on both sides. They're going to elongate, oh, my gosh, the market's bad. It's going to go down. And it's funny because I don't remember when it was. There was a particular, not too long ago, somebody said to me, well, how are the markets doing? Things are pretty good. I'm like, what were you looking at? What were you looking at? I don't understand what you're saying here, because, you know, maybe they were just happy that maybe the gas prices were down, but that's not really good for their oil stocks that they own in their portfolio.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, maybe they'll look at, maybe in a low-kill area, like here in Florida, we have a lot of building that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the real estate market must be good. But you know what? If the guy in Texas called me, he'd be like, things aren't so good.
Yeah.
You know? Uh-huh. So I guess it's all a matter of your perspective, like you said, and it's kind of clearing that and kind of taking the high. I guess the other thing is, so how does the news affect people in terms of, I mean, we know that obviously it depends on what you watch and your, you know, if you are a person that is maybe negative, and you, have you found this, by the way? I don't know if you've studied this, but if you're negative and in a particular area you look at, you're attracted to that kind of, and confirmation bias.
Right. Exactly. You're right on, Andrew. And people are affected most of the times when they are trying to make decisions, they're not asking you for advice per se. They're asking you, and then if you agree with them, they'll say, oh yeah, you're a genius. If you don't agree with them, well, you know, I'm going to ask somebody else. Right.
Right. It's like the story of the guy that goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, you need surgery. He says, all right, I'm going to get a second opinion because I don't want to get surgery.
That's right.
You know, I'm going to get a second opinion. The second opinion says, you need surgery. Five times he goes to five different doctors. They all say you need surgery. The final one says, you know what? You don't think you need surgery. He says, I knew I didn't need surgery.
I knew I didn't need that. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Right. So it's confirmation bias. And all. Well, I appreciate you coming on and clearing up some of the things, good things. I think one of the things we got out of this that I think is kind of interesting is the whole idea of the consumption requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And if, in fact, if you can get your head around the fact that if it is not an account or not a portfolio position that is required for consumption, like maybe IRAs or 401ks or pension plans that you may not have as a young person, a need for the future, that's something that you maybe should be thinking about. Hey, consider looking at a different process and not being as emotional. Whereas if it is oriented towards short-term needs, well, then maybe it shouldn't have been invested in the first place. Mm-hmm. But you may want to look at that also differently. So that's kind of, I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, always looking at some of this. Well, Ray Yao from University of Missouri, and also writer, et cetera, et cetera. I really appreciate you coming on board.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's going to about wrap it up for this edition of the Discipline Investor Podcast. Again, hope you enjoy your elongated weekend. Spend some time with your Valentine. And of course, if you want more information on either Jordan Goodman or Ray Yao, you can go on to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out what's going on there. And of course, I hope that you will listen into Tuesday night, get it Wednesday, on DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak speak about all sorts of things related to business news, and some of the craziness that goes on. It's a fun show if you haven't listened so far. Thanks again for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.